Welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that eats its young. Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast. I am one of your hosts, just one of two. I am a hemisphere. I'm half a man. Joined by my co-host, you complete me, Fintan Costello. Hello, Fintan.
Hello, John.
You had me at...
it's the asthma.
I feel your pain. Fintan, what have you been up to?
I've been doing CrossFit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've nearly there's nearly a hint of a bicep, which is quite exciting. Like if I really, really squeeze and really, really squint, I can nearly see the outline of a bicep. So that's, you know.
I'd show you mine, but I can't get my sleeve up past my bicep.
You gotta rip the sleeves off now, don't you? You just ripped them off.
That's a sure sign generally of somebody that has no muscles.
Gun show. Apart from that, just busy doing stuff, work, just normal stuff. I lead a very boring life.
Do you though?
I do. Well, sort of. I do.
Where are you as we record this?
I'm in my hotel room in London.
So you travel to London for work?
I took the train. It's amazing. So I can get a 4-hour train. The Eurostar directly from Amsterdam to St. Pancras.
So, Sam, where does the train originate?
Amsterdam Central, Central Station in Amsterdam.
So that's the terminus?
Yep.
And then where does it go?
It goes...
I need to know all the stops.
There's only four, so it's pretty easy. Amsterdam, Rotterdam, Antwerp. And then we just skip straight through France, through the Eurotunnel. And into St. Pancras. And it was delightful. Yeah, it's so much less stress in the airport. And there's sort of Wi-Fi in it. So you can do a little bit of work if you want. Or I just watch Netflix movies. And
it's probably quite a bit more comfortable than being on a plane as well.
Yeah, it's way more comfortable. It's a lot less stress. There's more space.
And how does it compare for price?
If you book in advance, it's definitely a little bit more expensive. But if you factor in like... the taxi to the airport's twice as much. If you land into Gatwick or Heathrow, you've still got to commute or if you're getting taxed. So when you kind of do like the net cost and time, as long as you book your train ticket a bit in advance, you're fine. It's much better.
Let me give you a great podcasting tip, Fintan.
Go for it.
Before you start podcasting, always make sure you've got a glass of water handy.
Okay.
Don't get sparkling water.
Oh, it's making you burp, is it?
That is a schoolboy error. I just didn't think that through, did I?
You didn't.
I was too taken up with the happy aspect of burping to think about.
You were just so focused on the bubbles.
Hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, I'd highly recommend it. And because Schiphol's a bit of a mess right now anyway, in terms of security queues. And so you never know what you're going to get. It's lovely.
Nice. Well, as you know, I spent a bit of time in Harwich, which is where the ferry goes for the hook.
What?
And
I've no idea. What's Harwich?
Harwich is a small town in Essex in the UK, and it's where the ferries leave from for the Hook of Holland.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And I think it's the largest container port in the UK as well. Well, it's just opposite. It's just opposite. Is it Felixstowe?
Felixstowe, yeah.
And Harwich. Oh, I was talking about Harwich a couple of weeks ago, I think, because I was saying it was the origin point of the Mayflower.
Oh, that's a fun fact.
Well, if you go around Harwich, there's all the blue plaques on the buildings, because of course all the crew was from Harwich. And it's where the ship's chandler was and all of that.
And why is the Mayflower held in such esteem in America?
Well, why it's is a ship considered? That took the pilgrims over to settle.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of, it's one of those, it's like, you know, a lot of American people are very, very into their genealogy, very into heritage, you know, oh, I'm Scots Irish. No, you're not, you're American.
Yeah.
But obviously they're referencing their heritage and sometimes going back generations.
Hmm.
But some people can, you know, trace their origins right back to the occupants of the Mayflower.
Interesting.
If you like that kind of shit. So Nathaniel Philbrick did In the Heart of the Sea, which is a truly magnificent book, but he also did a biography of the Mayflower.
Oh, okay, cool.
I actually bought in hardback. I love In the Heart of the Sea so much. I bought the next one in hardback. And sometimes you love a book so much that you don't read the next thing that they write because you're worried it's going to be shit.
I've never had that thought cross my mind. I'm just yes, I'm really excited about their next book.
It might just be me. So Geoffrey Eugenides, right? He's possibly my favorite living writer. And his first two books, The Virgin Suicides was his first novel.
Okay.
Followed by Middlesex, both of which were just utterly extraordinary and completely different. And I was so excited for his third book. I bought it the day it came out, I think. Probably about 7 or 8 years ago now. And I've still not read it. He's actually brought another one out since then, which I also bought on the day it was published. Glenn David Gold, there's another one. Brilliant book, Carter Beats the Devil. Fabulous. Beautiful little novel. Loved it. Bought the next book as soon as I could. You wouldn't believe the sun fading on the cover of that book because I'm just like, you know what I mean? It's like...
You just got the fear.
I don't want to lose the magic. It's like I've been a fan of Pearl Jam since I was like 16, right? They released an album. I can't remember if it was. I think it was last year, called Gigaton, and I was the usual level of excited. Fuck, new Pearl Jam album, fucking brilliant. Got it, bought it, downloaded it. It was shite. I mean, it was so bad. And I've never hated it. Some of their stuff's been a bit more middling.
Hmm.
But this album, I actually hated it.
Oh, dear.
And I still went to see them in Hyde Park in the summer. Pixies supporting. Oh. And I'm standing there in the middle of Hyde Park watching this band that I've been, you know, watching and listening to for 30 years. And I was bored shitless. And this is one of the world's great live bands. Admittedly, fourth time I've seen them. The set list has been different every time I've seen them. But I suddenly became acutely aware that once you take away the stuff from the first three or four albums, it's actually quite dull. And I think it's probably a change in me. It's probably not them. But anyway. Well, I might have digressed a bit there. Sorry.
Yeah, I get it because it's, you know, a book or music or a band or a movie, if it's great and it hits you at that certain point of wherever you are in your life kind of thing, it's that kind of Venn diagram where you create magic, I think. And you create that kind of lifelong fan or that one thing that you rave about or whatever. But then, yeah, everybody moves on.
Just speaking of Venn diagrams.
Yeah.
I'm just going to check I can find this.
Go on.
I think, yeah, there it is. There's possibly one of the greatest, possibly the greatest Venn diagram ever. You can find it just by Googling the term "what the fuck Venn diagram." It is just, it's like, it's like having a manual to live by. Have you just Googled it? I mean, how good is that?
It's also a great way to explain Venn diagrams to kids.
That's very, very, very fair.
That's how you learn Venn diagrams. Brilliant.
There's another one. I'm just going to see if I can find it. There it is. Yeah. This one is slightly different. You might have to do a Google image search. It's people from Hull and people that invented the Venn diagram. That's my two favorite Venn diagrams for my whole life. It's weird, nice. The shit you remember, isn't it?
Nice.
So, Fintan, you came up with today's guest on the podcast, and it's slightly different to usual.
Yes, it is.
How so?
So today we're not talking to somebody from the gambling industry.
What?
I know. However, I did get introduced to them through somebody who works in the gambling industry. It's the Danish Support Group Ukraine, DSGU.org. And they're also on Facebook. And we had Per on from the charity. And there are a bunch of Danish people who didn't want to sit around and just watch things happen in Ukraine and wanted to help. So Per kind of talks us through the story of the charity and kind of how they came about this year. And it's crazy that it's only been it hasn't even been 12 months with everything going on in Ukraine. And what they're doing right now is they're helping to demine and clear up munitions and booby traps and mines and leftover shells and mortars and all this kind of stuff. I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but it's shit. No, I can't even get the city name. Anyway, one of the key cities in Ukraine, and it's a phenomenal charity, and they're doing amazing work. And I think everybody should get behind it.
Who introduced you?
I'm not sure if he's public about it. One second.
Out him.
No, well, some people like.
Oh, it's fine. I just wondered if it was, said to a friend of the podcast.
No, not a friend of the podcast. Oh no, he's definitely publicly talking about it. So it's Jimmy. I've not even his surname. Maelstrup. So he's the CEO of Vita Media Group, which is a Danish based gambling affiliate. We met at the name dropping there. We met at the EGR Power Affiliate event earlier on in the year. In the 5-star resort in Spain, somewhere, Marbella.
Yeah, the next part is the part where you confess that you were serving canapes.
I was sculling the free beers. Particularly at that point of the year. So Jimmy told me all about it. And I think for me, it resonated because it's one of those, with what's happening in Ukraine right now, it is one of those completely change the world type events. And there's a lot of virtue signaling in terms of, I updated my people, people changed their Twitter profile to a Ukraine flag or kind of virtue signaling like that. And, I'm not at the point where I'm going to go get a gun and I'd be completely useless to do anything. Right. But this felt like a way to help in a really positive way. And like Per talks about, a lot of the victims of these munitions is kind of children and stuff who are out playing. They stumble across it and then horrific things happen. But also a lot of farmland is locked up because of it's not safe and things like that as well. So there's huge ramifications there. And I touch on it a little bit in the podcast, but I'd like to be on the right side of history with this. If you watch, it's being dramatic, right? If you watch kind of any history channel, it's like World War II and all these things happened. And do you want to be the person who kind of stands back? And I think that's to live through one of those moments is really profound, I think. And it's a really good kind of character test of, you know, gas prices, you know, electricity and gas prices are rising in Europe. Does that mean Ukraine will get less support from Europeans because of that inconvenience of it's cold in their house? And those kind of things. And I think things like apathy are really dangerous. And I also think it's, you know, the way news cycles work as well. Like, if it's not top of the news cycle, it's easy to forget and assume everything's going okay. Or, you know,
the flip side of that as well is when it's always at the top of the news cycle, people become
you get numb to
resistant.
It, right?
Yeah.
And I think as well, you've got, like, obviously the Ukraine army's had a lot of success lately, but it's far from over. You know, the major cities are getting shelled on a regular basis. There's definitely infrastructure issues, right? You know, so this isn't it's not done. They haven't won. It's far from over. I think, personally speaking, I think Putin's kind of a mob boss-esque type mentality, so he can't lose. So I think this is far from over. So anyway, so Per and the guys are doing amazing work on the ground, with the full support of the local authorities, and just best practice. Yeah, just they're global experts on the ground in terms of what they're doing. And I think we talked briefly about it, John, but I think we should make them our new sponsor. And talk
a,
about
a new sponsor. A new sponsor.
And I also think if there's, obviously we've got a lot of people, senior people in the industry listening. If you would like to contribute in a very positive way to people on the ground in Ukraine, please contact Per and the group, or contact me and I can introduce you, or whatever it is that you want to do. And I think we could do a lot more as an industry to help. And I know it's a very generous industry. And there's probably a lot of, you know, a lot of your IT equipment or coding has probably been built by Ukrainians as well. So there's a business.
Oh, yeah, there's an industry. I mean, there's an enormous amount of companies that were, well, still are theoretically Ukraine-based or have Ukrainian staff.
Exactly.
And have been, you know, as an industry, we've been very directly affected. We all know people who've had some pretty awful shit to deal with ongoing.
Yeah. I've got some friends and I've heard some stories about getting out and things like that. So that, yeah, look, it's a war zone. Like that's it. It's as simple and brutal as that.
Okay. That's very serious. So I'm going to tell you a joke.
Go on.
I say a joke. It's a true story that I overheard one morning. Oh, no, I can't tell you that one. That's rude. No, I'm not going to tell you a joke.
Okay.
I was going to, but then I just realized I really can't do with that one.
Boo.
Sorry. And now I can't think of any clean ones. I could go with like an old favorite though. Like, you know, I can't tell you my real favorite joke because that is properly wrong. It's one of those jokes you've got to be really careful who you tell it to. It's wrong. So I'm not going to tell you that one. I'm going to tell you the one about... I might have told you this one before. It's a true story. It's not a joke. The chap I know, his best mate was a giraffe. Did I tell you about him taking his giraffe to the pub, his giraffe mate?
No.
They went to the pub and they were having a nice time. They got very drunk. And he got up to leave and my mate's just weaving out of the pub and the giraffe, he gets up and he can't hold his drink, Leon. He can't. He gets up and he just goes over, middle of the pub, passes out. Barman shouts to my mate. He goes, "Hey, you can't leave that lying there." It's not a lion. It's a giraffe. As Fintan says, if anybody wants an introduction to Per and his group and wants to help promote meaningful change and to help people that are actually, you know, up to their elbows in this and who are out there doing the job, then get in touch, please. And they will be, they'll be one of our sponsors going forward after the end of November, which is when our agreement with Sporting Tech. Actually, Fenton, do you need an iGaming platform?
I was asked the other day, could I recommend a platform?
And you said?
I said Sporting Tech.
Fabulous. My work here is done. I bet you were there and you were singing the sea shanty advert.
It was top of mind. It was like, what's the name of those guys?
Legendary.
All that cool stuff.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Nice people. Kind to their mothers. Good in bed. Perfectly legible handwriting. Sporting Tech, that's it. We're there, our sponsors, Fintan, for another however long until the end of November. So, you know.
Brilliant.
Enjoy the episode. It is a little different. Let us know your thoughts. Feedback always welcomed. Also, I'm just going to have a quick, just a quick, tiny, quick, clickety link. I'm just going to have a quick, where's my face on this thing? I'm on LinkedIn. I'm looking, there it is, Gambling Files podcast page. We've got 589 followers on LinkedIn.
That's nice.
I'd quite like 11 more, though.
Of course. And what's really interesting is when you look at the analytics behind that,
they're
all really senior. It's all like CEOs and founders.
Not
and
all. There's some directors,
directors and SVPs. And
no, there's some real scum in there.
No, they're all legends. All legends. Everyone.
I'm not saying they're not nice. It's a social classification. I'm not judging them as people.
That sounded judgy. It sounded very judgy.
Well, that shows what you know. Enjoy the episode and thank you for joining us.
Does your life suck? Do you stare at the ceiling at night thinking, holy shit, there's got to be more to life than this? This is awful. I can't believe I'm doing the same shit over and over again. You should try Sporting Tech. They can't fix your shitty life, but they can take care of all of your iGaming platform needs. All of them. Oh, yes. Sporting Tech. Because life sucks ass.
We move to our first guest, our only guest. I don't know why I keep saying that. I've got some kind of hangover from back when we used to have more than one guest. This episode, this was organized by Fintan. So if it all goes horribly wrong, please just email him. Any voodoo, witchcraft, anything like that, point it all at Fintan. Much appreciated. We are joined by Per Rangard, board member of the Danish Support Group Ukraine. Per, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you might not thank me in a bit. Per, first things first, what does the Danish Support Group Ukraine do? What's your sort of mission statement?
I guess our mission statement is, I think it goes back to also the cartoonish way of saying if you have the ability, you also have some responsibility. So when war broke out, a couple of us veterans and other law enforcement people came together and thought we could do something. Initially, the focus was quite wide. We just tried to help where it made sense and we could see it had an effect. And then over time, we focused on demining, as it is a huge issue in Ukraine.
So when you say demining, we're talking about landmines?
We're talking about landmines. We're also talking about ammunition parts that have been left behind, both deliberately, like in booby traps and all kind of mines and improvised mines, but also the undeliberate left behind stuff that could be ammunition parts that have been forgotten, or the Russians have evacuated a bit fast, so they have not had the time to to take all their belongings with them. Could also be tanks that have been left behind, where there will still be some ammunition part in, which means it poses a big risk to try and move these vehicles when you don't know what's in them.
Okay, so let's take a little step back. DSGU, I'm assuming, did not exist before the conflict in Ukraine. How did the organization come about? How did it evolve? Who started it?
Yeah, that is correct. I have my own company with two other partners where we do consulting, both mostly project management. Where we, and I think our unique kind of DNA is that we have a business history and military or law enforcement history, and it provides us, with another tool set to achieve results than like normal consultancies. And I think also with the military background, we you can't just sit back and watch like the events unfold like we saw with Russia invading Ukraine. I mean, it's both something very similar to what we've seen before, but also quite close to home this time. So we started calling around in our network, and I think during the first day we found like 10, 12 guys who are willing to also to put in some time or some resources to establish something. And the next day, me and Torbjörn, who is the chairman of DSGU, we left for Poland to set up an office down there and try to get an overview of like which actors were operating in the area and what the biggest needs were and what the biggest obstacles were to deliver on those needs. And that's also, I mean, it has changed a lot, the actual task that we have done. Initially, one of the biggest challenges we saw, and reason why I struggle a bit with challenge, because it wasn't a challenge. I mean, a lot of private individuals were sending a huge amount of donations to Ukraine. But the thing was, there was no mechanisms in place to actually receive this stuff, to sort it, to reload it, and to send it to the areas where the need actually was. So we worked with the Ukrainians there and tried to figure out what we can do, and not in any way to take credit. I mean, this was the Ukrainians, but we pushed a lot for it so they could make some reception centers in the surrounding countries, so the borders weren't overwhelmed with these amount of donations. And then we tried to communicate a lot to the Danish people we're working with. So we were sure that the stuff was sent to where it made the most sense, and then the Ukrainians could take over and distribute it to where they saw the needs. And from there, yeah, the organization changed a bit. It got organized more formally, and we started to focus on which tasks actually make sense for us to fulfill on, and which not. So we needed a kind of focus to continue doing this work.
And what was so in terms of the focus, and obviously you've ended up with a very specific focus for the charity and the tasks being done. What were the other areas that you guys looked at?
In general, or in the demining specifically?
In general, just before you got, like, because obviously you said like it sounds like you kind of went through a few iterations before you got to demining, or was like demining number one on the list all the time?
No, we looked at quite some others, and I think that the biggest projects we looked at before the demining was were helping with rebuilding some houses, just residential houses in Chernihiv, and mm-hmm. We're also providing water in Mykolaiv, which got tanked, I think it's called, on huge trucks in Odessa and then driven to Mykolaiv. I think the downside of those projects, they were harder to control, and harder to scale, as they were very reliant on specific partners who were also volunteering, or I mean that a lot of Ukrainians have some duality in their life currently. I mean that they both have a totally normal job probably, and then they have some other functionality. It could be in that they're in a local organization trying to rebuild houses. They may be in another initiative where they try to provide water for Mykolaiv. We also seen some that run like soup kitchens or shelters and all kind of stuff, or they're more participating, so or combatants, so they are National Guard, or maybe even in the territorial defense in some way or shape. So to work with them is it poses some difficulty, because they, I mean that they need to have their life, that they need to focus on their life, and so that they don't often have that much energy to spare.
Sure.
To scale a project with us, so you need to find someone else, and it's a bit difficult to try and to organize stuff when it's on a voluntary basis with people that have other things to do and other very important things to do. I mean, taking care of the family.
Yeah, of course. I know, like, even outside of a war zone situation, anybody who's done any sort of charity work or organized any sort of charity work would face the same problems.
For sure,
Under normal circumstances, let alone during a military conflict. So obviously then talk more about the demining and kind of how you guys came about to that. And it's obviously such a specialist task. I'm assuming you didn't just show up with a metal detector and get going, right? So how did that get going, and what kind of expertise did you bring in for that?
Yeah, that's true. I think the background for us is that we did a lot of different projects, and all of those projects, sooner or later, it just came up that it is a huge problem with those ammunition parts that have been left behind, and the stories are just horrible, because oftentimes it's always the children, right?
Of course.
And I think that just to take it a step back as well, is like our main focus with the NGO that we created was also to help the people or populations who are affected by this situation. So it's not, but we don't have any like political stance in any of it, or try to be part of the conflict itself. I guess that's a whole other conversation, but it's just to underline that we are just trying to help the people who are affected by this, who have in no way been part of creating these terrible circumstances for themselves. And demining, I mean, we just saw it when the Russians left, and especially the areas around Kyiv, that people were just still getting hurt by these ammunition parts long after the Russians have been hurt. And you see it in other conflict zones too, that is just a problem that just perpetuates itself for many years, right? And it also posed a huge logistical problem, because we're also trying to boil down a long conflict into a couple of minutes, but when the Russians pushed forward to Kyiv and on, a lot of Ukrainians left. I think it was up about like 10 million Ukrainians who emigrated out of the country. And they left their house, their belongings and all the stuff behind. But there were quite a lot of them, which we also saw in Poland, a lot of them, they didn't even want to settle as you normally see migrants, right? They try to get themselves comfortable because they don't know how long they're going to be. Where the Ukrainians were a bit opposite, they were not going to make themselves comfortable because they were like, I need to get home soon. So because they didn't see themselves as migrants. Sure. But the Russians had been in those areas that have previously been their homes, and we're talking totally normal, like suburban areas. But so they couldn't necessarily come home. And then you had the Ukrainian police force and the emergency service that tried to clear some of the areas. And by the way, that was a very had a high death toll too, because they didn't necessarily have either the competences or the tools to do this safely. So a lot of lives have been lost to this effort just before we came, at least. And probably still happens a lot. But they needed to clear those houses before people could return. But the amount of houses, or just the scale of areas that needed to be cleared for people to be able to come back to their houses, was just much bigger than the resources available to the emergency services and police and stuff like that. So it posed a huge logistical problem because people couldn't return to their homes. And what do you do when you can't return to your homes? And either you get someone to clear it for you who doesn't have the competences themselves, or you just do it yourself, which furthermore costs death and suffering, right? So it was a lot of those stories that we heard, that children found stuff that was dangerous in the streets or in the playgrounds or in the woods or stuff like that, and played with it and got injured or died. And also people coming back to their homes and finding stuff that had been left behind, and in those cases often deliberately by the Russians, like booby traps and all other terrible stuff. So it was those kind of stories of the people we're working with in Ukraine that got us thinking that we need to do something, or try and do something about this. Also because the solution to it, in our ears at least, seemed quite simple. I mean, we just need to send some people who knows something about this, send them down there and, have them get to work. But it was a bit more difficult than we anticipated. But I think we're also a bit naive sometimes when it comes to bureaucracy and formality and stuff like that.
Well, that's I think every entrepreneur is naive in a way, but clearly you need to think big in order to make things happen as well. So, but clearly you have made stuff happen and you've overcome some of the bureaucracy. So, have you found a team, and what's happening now then?
The biggest obstacle was that. Just a bit to go back to that, because that also leads us to how we solved it. Ukraine is quite bureaucratic, which for some at least may come as a surprise. But they are quite bureaucratic, and they have municipalities, they have the government, and then they have a lot of bureaucratic entities in and around that. And as soon as the Russians they pulled a bit back, before when there were still Russians all the way up to Kyiv, it was a very lawless in some sense. I mean, it really had a vibe of like full scale war going on, where you just solve things and you settle like formalities and bureaucracy later. But when they pulled back, the bureaucratic processes sort of reestablished themselves a bit. And unfortunately, while they reestablished themselves, their focus was still a lot on the war, which is obvious. But that meant that they upheld their expectations, their bureaucratic expectations, while not having the scale to actually handle it or process it. So in order to demining in Ukraine, you need an accreditation, or you need to be registered, and you need to be approved and have an accreditation of the, and that's the second thing. They don't really know where this accreditation process where it lies currently. I think it's because, I mean, a lot of resources are going to pull into the country. So it's whether it's Department of Interior, Department of Defense, or whatever. So that's also, there's a bit of power struggle as to where this particular field should rely, like legally or bureaucratically. So at the end of the day, we needed some sort of accreditation. So we found through some other NGOs that we knew, some American NGOs, we found an American NGO operating in Ukraine who had some contacts to what was called, or still is called, the Ukrainian Demining Association, which is an association of what it sounds like, but both on a company level, so Ukrainian demining companies, but also on a personal level, so Ukrainian citizens with demining education. Mm-hmm. So we linked up with them, and then we found one of their the founders of this organization. He also had wouldn't say a shell company, but he had focused more on the association rather than his own business. That was actually the offset to starting the association in the first place. So he wasn't operating with his own company, but he did have an authorization and an accreditation to actually work, and he had a really good network with the state emergency services and the police and the Ministry of Defense. So we connected with him and had a couple of meetings, and we sent a guy down there to also have some physical meetings to see what he was all about and how he thought that we could work together. And then we found a Danish partner through our network who also does demining. He has done demining in Kuwait and a lot of countries in Africa and Iraq, Syria, Libya, all over the world. So they had some really competent people. So we got him to not sponsor, but give us a good deal on one guy who could act as mentor and as team leader and with the highest qualifications. And I think you've seen him before. I think I sent something about him, but his name was Andy. He's a British guy, has level 3+, I think, in the international demining standards, which is the highest level. So he's straight out of, they don't like references to the Hurt Locker, but if they did, he would be that guy. He can defuse booby traps and conventional mines and all the way to terrorist bombs. So we sent him down there with a lot of gear that they needed, and then Tumor, which is the guy from the Ukrainian company, he found a lot of deminers in this network, in the Ukrainian Demining Association network. Which, by the way, right now there are 400 unemployed Ukrainian deminers in Ukraine, which was also, I'm getting a bit sidetracked, but I think it's relevant anyway, because in Denmark we saw a lot of people who, like on government level, that they wanted to address this too. So they wanted to send either Danish deminers down there, or they wanted to take Ukrainians out of Ukraine and then give them an education to become a D-miner or stuff like that. Whereas we thought, like, I mean, if you have 400 unemployed D-miners in your country, I mean, we're not going to bring in more D-miners if they already have them. So we might as well use some of the unemployed they have in there, make sure we have a very qualified person that we trust very much, have him give them additional education, make sure to verify their education and to guide and mentor them on the ground. So that was sort of what we did. So we found those two partners, the Danish partner who contributed with a team leader and a mentor, and sort of our eyes on the ground, and then a Ukrainian partner who found the manpower and has the contacts to the local authorities and has the license to operate. And then they we got given an area south of Chernihiv of 2.3 million square meters. And the reason they say it in that way actually is because it may seem like as an exaggeration, you could say acres or square kilometers or something like that instead, but they actually clear like square meter for square meter to be certain that there is nothing in the ground that can pose a danger to the local population, because at the end of the day, it's just about releasing this land back to the local population. And you need to be certain that there's nothing in the ground to be actually able to release it back, right? So that is what they're currently doing.
And what kind of land is it? Is it residential, farmland, forest, kids' playgrounds?
It is combination of residential and farmland. But what makes this area interesting is that it's both it's both farmland, so it used to be used to farm, and especially this was mostly used to feed the local population, which poses a big problem when it gets warmer in the weather again, and they need to, or the local people rely on the crops that came from this land. But the other thing is that it was used as positions when they targeted Chernihiv. So in this area, there are a lot of both like infantry positions and sniper positions, but there are also a lot of artillery positions that they used to target Chernihiv. And that just means there is a lot of crap in this area. And as soon as there is this crap, you don't know which of it is dangerous and which of it is just garbage. So they don't use this land. And again, a lot of the local population are reliant on this land either to you know, get feed or get fed by this this crop, or to get like economy from working with these crops.
Yeah, of course. And it obviously then if it was a super active area for military, and it's also the farmland where people are either working to earn money or to be fed. Yeah, it's a huge issue.
For sure.
And so the 2.5 million square meters, like what kind of, in such an active area, how many square meters could be cleared in a day, or how does that work?
I think it's probably too volatile to say per day, but I think they do, in average, they've done around 300,000 square meters per month.
Okay.
So we expect them to do, I think they've done half of it before the winter really sets in. They had snow the other day, so I think we're looking at some of the last days that they'll be able to demine as we speak. And then they will pick it up again in March, probably, March or April. And they'll probably be done with this whole area around May, I think.
Got it. But then obviously there's potential issues then, say, if there's further attacks or something that happens between now and March, that they might have to redo some areas that they've currently cleared and things like that as well, right? So it's not like you've done it once and it's done. It's an ongoing process.
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, this is going to be a challenge for the next 10, 20, 30 years maybe.
Yeah.
And this area where we are at, I mean, it was heavily sieged for a short amount of time. Not to demean anyone. I mean, if you live there, it probably felt like ages. But you know, relatively speaking to normally how much you can leave behind, it was quite short. Whereas if you look at Kharkiv and Kherson and the more like southeastern regions, I mean, there is going to be so much both damage done to residential areas, so the rebuilding required there, but also the stuff that is left behind that is going to make it just difficult to both rebuild and move back and repopulate this area. So yeah, it's going to be a huge issue for many years.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then in terms of your charity and funding and like keeping this team leader on the ground, or maybe more, like what's the plans, and how are you guys going about raising funds, and what does that look like?
The way we've done it, we actually had like a three-phased funding scheme as we expected to do it. So the first phase, or the short term, was private individuals, companies in our network, our own company and own like network of people who were sort of involved with this to sort of get us going. And then the second part, the midterm, as one might call it, was foundations in Denmark who support this, where it fell into sort of their mission vision description of improving people's lives or making the day safer for anybody. We tried to approach some of them. We thought this would take a bit longer than go to people we knew. And then the third one, the long-term funding, is obviously getting money from government, either the Danish or it could be another government. The unfortunate there is that in Denmark we just recently had an election, and that means that just a month, or I think 2 months up to the election, they already knew that the election was coming, so their focus was on just the election, and everything else was just not that important. And after the election, the government still hasn't been formed. So right now we don't have a government, which also means that nobody will decide on anything. So that has been a bit unfortunate. We are in talks with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and also the Danish military Ministry of Defense, and also the Swedish and actually the Dutch as well. But it hasn't really. I think the Danish government should be the first to fund it, because they will also send a good signal to other foreign entities that they validate the project. So we were hoping that could happen a bit faster, but they haven't really they haven't contributed with anything specific yet, although a lot of encouraging words, and that we can we should look into this as soon as a new government is formed.
That's a classic politician response.
Yeah, it is.
This is great. I'll look into it in the future. Thank you very much. So obviously then, look, this is phenomenal work that you guys are doing. That I think for people listening and things, it's super easy to put out a LinkedIn message or update your Twitter bio with the Ukraine flag. But when there's people actually doing real work on the ground that affects families and kids and people trying to feed their family, this is a phenomenal charity to support. And I think the way I kind of looked at it was, at some point in the future, my son's going to realize what happened in Ukraine during this time period and how close it was. And we've got Ukrainian friends and stuff. And he's going to ask me, like, well, what did we do to help?
Yeah, what do you do?
Yeah. And I think that's a super powerful question. And I want to be on, personally, I want to be on the right side of that. So I would ask, anybody listening who wants to donate or help, where can they find you guys? What can they do? How do they contact you?
Well, happy you asked. And also very happy that you involved Fintan and gave us this opportunity also to talk a bit about it. But they can find us on on the web, it's dsdu.org. And on both LinkedIn and Facebook, search for either DSDU or Danish Support Group Ukraine, and we will pop up.
That's brilliant. Anything else to add or anything else?
I mean, we could talk for days about demining and all the anecdotes surrounding them. Maybe we should mention the robots.
Well, I think my son would shoot me if we didn't talk about the robots. Go for it.
Let's talk about the robots then. It's a fun story as well, because we reached out to a Canadian producer of those bomb disposal robots, and we didn't really expect them to buy into it, because this was also very early. And now I'm saying very early, I mean the whole charity is very young, so it's everything is very, very recently, right? But it was before we really got established with the demining, and they actually decided to donate two bomb disposal robots. A rather big one and then a more portable one. It also, it felt a bit unreal, because I think it's a donation. I mean, they said it was worth around like 500,000, those two robots combined. So it was a very generous donation from them also. So yeah, they're supposed to head down to Ukraine as soon as we are confident that these like bureaucratic and formal procedures, as always, they are cleared out of the way, so they don't get confiscated at the border when you try to get them in. But they will hopefully give us an extra extra way of handling some of these disposals of these dangerous elements. A lot of people, when we showcased them here in Denmark as well, and the politicians, by the way, they love to take pictures with the robots too. So we had them out, and they petted a robot. But people have a tendency to think that they do a lot of like you can set them out or just unleash them, and then they will go out and find bombs on their own. But they're just to be seen as a human equivalent. So if you find something and you deem it too unsafe for a human, then you can use this robot to remove it or destroy it or whatever you deem necessary, right? So you limit the risk for the personnel on the ground. And we're looking really forward to that, both because it's a capacity that not many else operators not many other operators have in Ukraine, but also because it will increase the safety for our people on the ground there. So we look forward to them. You can see pictures of those on both social media and on our website too.
Fantastic. And yeah, because it's not like setting off a Roomba to kind of just go out and hoover up.
No, exactly.
Munitions, right? Exactly, there's somebody on the other end of the wire kind of driving it to do whatever needs to happen, I'm assuming.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people had the Roomba picture in their head when they saw these robots.
Well, maybe there's a business for that as well. If somebody clever can come up with it.
For sure.
That's fantastic. And any other types of challenges or anything else you guys are facing that you want to share?
No, not really. If anybody knows, anybody in government who have an ambition to support demining, we'll happily either invite them over or come by to discuss what we do and can do and what our ambitions are for next year, and then we can talk.
Fantastic. So people can find you at dsgu.org, and it's a Danish Support Group Ukraine, and you're also on Facebook as well under the same name. And please get in touch, please donate some money or some contacts for government or other sponsors and stuff, and help make a big difference on the ground in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on. And
thank you so much for having me.
Brilliant. Right. If you just hang on the line, John will be here in a second. And what he's going to do is he's going to stop the recording. and then your file, both our file, audio files will upload to him. And then we can say our goodbyes and hang up.
Okay.
So just one second, I'll just send him a quick ping. So look, really, look, thanks so much for that. Really interesting and amazing what you guys are doing. And I totally agree with the, you know, sitting back and watching it on the news is one thing, and actually trying to do something to help is something completely different. So it's a huge thing you guys are doing. So really well done, and a big thank you.
This is Mike. Mike's boss asked him to find a new iGaming platform for the company's multi-million dollar new project. Mike found one, but it wasn't very good. In fact, it was shitty. Now Mike's partner has left him. He has no friends, and he recently caught crabs. Possibly from a dirty toilet seat. Don't be like Mike. Choose Sporting Tech.
Sporting Tech, for all your iGaming platform needs. Other iGaming platforms are available. If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just @GamblingFiles. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.